The COVID-19 pandemic comes to Indiana. A bill to deal with Curtis Hill dies as the 2020 session ends. Plus, charter schools sharing referendum money and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 13th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the dramatic impact of coronavirus hit the state and country as the situation changed seemingly by the minute. Indiana's first confirmed coronavirus case was in Marion County from someone who's recently returned from a conference in Boston where cases had sprung up. Health officials called it a when-not-if situation for the state. Since then, the number of Hoosier cases is in the double digits and expected to grow. Avon Community Schools shut down for nearly a month. Other K-12 schools followed. So too did the state's major universities, some for the rest of the semester. And the Big Ten tournament in Indianapolis and the NCAA men's and women's postseason tournaments were ultimately canceled, dealing the state major economic blows. How is the state handling the response to coronavirus? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. Lindsay Erdody, state government reporter for the Indianapolis Business Journal. And Nikki Kelly, state house reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting state house reporter Brandon Smith. Now, Ann, we are going to have a lot to talk about around COVID-19 over the next days few days and weeks to come. But right now, at the start of it, are you confident so far in how state government is leading on this issue?
Are you kidding me? They're not leading at all. Okay, they're being dragged along. We now have an announcement from the governor that no groups higher than 250 should meet. Wow. I mean, the one who's showing initiative, it seems to me, is Governor Cuomo in New York. You can declare a state of emergency. You start doing all of these things to contain the virus. We're not doing that. We're not testing. I mean, we don't know how widespread the problem is in Indiana, and we're probably not going to know under the ineffectual leadership both at the national and the state level. We're probably not going to know exactly how widespread this are and how much of a danger that we're in. It is just not acceptable to do or to not do what Governor Holcomb is. He's just not done anything.
The governors of Michigan and Ohio closed all the schools. Yesterday, in the last couple of days, they said through March,
yesterday,
go
Thursday.
Home. Right. Governor Holcomb, even today, talking with reporters, said, I didn't want to go that far. He called the effects of that draconian and said, I want to leave that up to local schools right now. Is that the right move?
Yeah, I think, look across the country, there are some best practices and things that everyone's doing, including the state of Indiana. You mentioned New York. I mean, the public gathering announcement from the governor yesterday on Thursday was within an hour of Cuomo doing it in New York. I mean, everybody's reacting to this at their own speed. This is also an effort in resource management. So if you're going to criticize not testing everybody or anybody that has these symptoms, I mean, there's a reason that the CDC is saying don't go to the hospital, call your doctor. And if you meet the testing criteria, then you'll get tested or put in isolation.
Some of this is we just don't have the tests.
We don't have the tests, and we don't have consistent criteria either.
And they can't put that kind of strain on the hospital system. That everybody, if you present these symptoms, go to the hospital. You can't, because you don't want those people gathering either. So I think they're working through this as people react to it, like humans react to it as well, and try to come up with, whatever kind of supplemental strategies need to be put in place to shut down all businesses or put these public gatherings and limits on that. They're doing.
We both spoke with the governor today, and one of his big themes is what he's calling flattening the curve. So trying to minimize some of the drastic impacts right now to hopefully make things a little easier down the line. Is that the sense you got too?
Yeah, that's definitely the approach he's trying to take right now, which is why we saw him come out with those recommendations yesterday to try to limit social gatherings. And he even said, is 250 the right number? I don't know, but it's the number we're going to land on for now. He is expected to come out with even more recommendations. And as to the school side of things, he may revisit that. You know, he didn't rule it out, but he just said for now, this is the approach we're taking. It's a very, day by day, we're trying to maintain and like you said, slow that curve to avoid a bigger problem and a more expensive problem long term.
I think the big 10 tournament at that point was a good example of people. I mean, their approach to that changed like by the hour until it was canceled.
But it didn't
right?
change and they kept, because of the governor. It changed moving. Because of private initiatives, as most of these things have.
State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box today told some reporters that, like they said in Ohio, the best guess is, yeah, about 1% of Indiana's population probably has this, which is 66,000 people, roughly. What we know is 12 people, because that's all the testing has been able to tell us so far. So we're never going to know the fullest impact. But it seems like right now it's just risk mitigation is the best course of action.
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Box admitted freely that they had enough tests to cover well over 100 Hoosiers. We have 6.6 million, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, they said the supply chain, the testing isn't just a simple, like, put it in, out, you're yes or positive. There are some reagents that they need, and the supply side of those to run the physical test is very low. So they're focusing on vulnerable populations. They're focusing on people in hospitals, people in nursing homes, healthcare workers, so they don't spread it. So they're just focusing on those populations for now, given the low number of testing that we have.
And two other things that Dr. Box said was, one, the state has reported that they've tested 73 people. We don't actually know how many people have been tested because there's private testing being done, and that's not reported to the state. But the other thing she said was, yes, we think about 1% of the population probably has it. But it's clearly not as bad in Indiana as it is, for instance, in Washington State, which has really seen significant problems here. And she said, we know that because we would be seeing more serious cases in the hospitals, and we just literally don't see that. So we know it hasn't gotten that bad so far in Indiana. The answer to all this is yet. This is what we know as of this moment, and that is
because of the delay in getting the test kits done, that we're not prepared to fully assess just how bad it's going to get.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, are you confident in Governor Eric Holcomb's ability to manage the coronavirus crisis? A yes or B no. Last week's question, who will be the Democratic nominee for president in 2020? 74% of you say it looks like it'll be Joe Biden. 20% say Bernie Sanders, and 6% say someone else. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. I think some people are still holding out for Tulsi Gabbard. Confusion remains. Yeah, she just clicked that button a lot. Confusion remains over whether Attorney General Curtis Hill will keep his job if his law license is suspended. That's because Senate Republicans couldn't agree to a bill on the issue as the 2020 legislative session ended this week.
A disciplinary hearing officer recommended Curtis Hill's license be suspended for 2 months without automatic reinstatement, which stems from groping allegations against the AG. If that happens, current law is unclear whether Hill could keep his job or be eligible to run for it this fall. House lawmakers, led by Speaker Todd Houston, wanted to address that. They passed a bill to force Hill out if his license were suspended for at least a month.
We felt like there needed to be clarity on that issue. We continued to press for clarity.
But Senate Republicans said no. Here's caucus leader Roderick Bray.
There was concerns about the timing of it because we're in an election year right now. We're in an election cycle right now.
Bray says Hill's fate will largely be up to voters. Houston calls the clarifying bill's failure the biggest missed opportunity of the session.
Mike O'Brien, Houston called this the biggest missed opportunity of the session. Is he right?
He might be. We're going to find out what the Supreme Court does, because if the Supreme Court says his license is in fact suspended before the convention,
but doesn't say anything else,
and doesn't say anything else, we're all looking at each other saying, "Well, what does that mean?" And that's what House Republicans were trying to. That's the question they were trying to answer. And Senator Bray's point, we're in an election year. There's this, among some Republicans, there's this desire to let the public decide this in an election year. But we have this mechanism in place for a reason. This disciplinary process, that mechanism, and a law that might say to be attorney general, you have to have an active law license. And so that question's not answered. So, and it throws into question, it doesn't matter if it's an election year or not, if it throws into question whether or not he's even able to be on the ballot. And if we answer that question too late, we don't have a candidate for attorney general. So that was the motivation by Republicans, at least on the House side, to try to get this answered.
Rod Bray said to reporters as the session ended that, you know, he wished that the law, that the General Assembly had addressed this question when they created the Attorney General, you know, decades and decades and decades and decades ago, or 10 years ago even. But that isn't what happened, so how much of a failure is this?
Oh, it's a complete failure. I mean, they should have impeached him 2 years ago, is what they should have done, and they didn't have the guts to do it. And so they try to slip this stuff in at the last minute and do, as my husband says, the impeachment by disguise, and they couldn't get it done. And so they're going to wind up with Curtis Hill as the nominee of the Republican Party for Attorney General, despite his conduct both before and after he accosted those women. So, you know, it's a plague on all their houses. They have super majorities and they couldn't get it done. It is a huge failure.
In their defense, no one thought when, you know, no one needed to clarify this law when Steve Carter was Attorney General. Because no one thought Steve Carter was a sexual predator. Who might have his law.
Are you trying to tell us that there's something we didn't know or what?
No, and if Steve's watching, he's a wonderful man. And a great Attorney General.
He could have been the Attorney General this time, but Curtis Hill beat him at the convention four years ago. Rod Bray's, well, this is an election year, we don't want to interfere with that. Are you buying that?
I don't know if I am. What I do know is that lawmakers had a chance to clarify a law, and they didn't do it. And there is a true, real possibility that we will not know who our attorney general is in a few months. Like, if he gets a suspension, you know, who is our attorney general? Do we appoint a new one? Do we not? I mean, this is all going to go to the courts.
Is it an acting attorney general that he names?
Right.
Is it just his chief deputy?
And that alone should be enough to give Hoosiers pause, whether this is an election year or not.
Because it's an election year, they needed to clarify it. Yeah. Was my point.
Whatever happens to Curtis Hill, should this be something that they come back next session and change anyway? Because maybe this will never, ever happen again, but just in case.
You could certainly make an argument for that next year.
You better clarify it.
If he wins, they won't do it then.
Oh, I mean, yeah, if he wins, and
it could happen again.
He's in office.
That's the point.
But because you're right, you didn't know you were going to have to need this clarity until the situation came up, and now you're stuck in this kind of limbo situation because they didn't take action to clarify it. So will they come back next year and do it? It obviously depends on a lot of different things. I think what was interesting with what Senate Republicans offered as a potential compromise only addressed running for the office. It didn't address staying in the office or being in the office. So to say it was about the election, I mean, that you could have been stuck in a scenario where Curtis Hill was in office but not allowed to seek re-election if that language would have gone through.
Yeah, the current attorney general would not have been eligible to run for the office he was holding.
Yes.
Interestingly, though, Senate Republicans publicly offered that compromise to House Republicans, then took it back to their own caucus, who rejected it. That was an interesting way for the session to end.
An appropriate one.
A last-minute change to a bill at the State House opens the door for charter schools to receive property tax funding through referendum measures. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us lawmakers approved the multi-purpose bill on the last day of the legislative session after more than an hour debating that referendum language.
The charter referendum splitting proposal was added to a tax bill last week. It would let school boards decide whether to share referendum money with charters. But ahead of the final vote, many Democrats, including Representative Earl Harris, spoke against it, saying it could trigger problems for public schools seeking referendum funding.
There is nothing stopping a charter organization from doing what I said they could do, which is go to the school district and say, pay us, or we will fight against it.
Many Republicans pushed back, saying locally elected school boards control the process.
Nikki Kelly, this is a May provision. Schools don't have to share this money, so is it much ado about nothing?
I don't know it is, but I'm going to go back to process, because process is important. You know, this is a short session. These are supposed to be emergencies. We didn't file this bill. We didn't have public hearings on this bill. There's no one asking for the bill, at least publicly. So why it was necessary to subvert and do all this kind of in the last minute and quietly and try to do that, it almost makes the discussion of the base part of the bill unimportant, because they've made a farce out of it. And to be fair, I think schools can already do this now. There's nothing stopping them from standing up and saying, if you approve this, we will give 10% to this charter school over here.
That's the point that I thought was pretty interesting is how many, because none of the public schools are out there really saying they want this. So
I think zero of them.
Yeah, so how many are going to then go ahead and do it?
Well, that's what extortion can be.
Well, absolutely. And that's, but the supporters of it were saying that they need this so they can get more support for the referendum because then charter schools will help them support it. But again, at the end of the day, if the public schools don't want it, then or aren't saying they need it.
I'm not always a fan of the slippery slope argument. I think it's overused. But that was made a lot here. There were a lot of people who raised what, to them at least, were very legitimate worries that if you put a may provision in the law today,
it's one word change.
It's going to be a shall provision tomorrow. Yeah. Is that a legitimate fear in this case?
I think it is a legitimate fear, and you're going to have a year or 2 years or 3 years and more referenda go through, and whoever wanted this, the charter schools, are going to come back and say, they didn't share any of that referendum money, even though we said we'd support their referendum, and now you've got to make it a mandate that if they buy in on or they support the referendum, they've got to get a share of that money.
Earl Harris kind of referenced this. You just referenced this, the idea of extortion.
Right.
So it is just a May provision, but is that still a problem?
Oh, I think it's a huge problem because these groups have a lot of money. Reform groups have a lot of money, and they've given a lot of money to the Republicans who voted for this, by the way. But that aside, what they can say to these people, to the school districts, is either you agree to a share of this or we will oppose the referendum. And we have unlimited resources nationally to do that. And, yeah, it's going to wind up being an extortion. And it's done by the Republicans at the last minute, slipped under the process because they don't want people focusing on how much money these groups have given them in contributions. And just because it has the name reform on it, they're all for it. We saw what happened with virtual schools.
I was going to say,
this.
Will they be able to share the money with virtual
schools? Oh, sure. Why not? Why not? They've only gotten $65 million of our tax money. There's more there.
Yeah, to that point, they can do all of this right now. Lawmakers approved a bill before session's end this week to expand the state's panhandling law with an eye towards what some say is a situation out of control in downtown Indianapolis. Panhandling is already illegal in Indiana under certain circumstances, like near an ATM. The approved bill would add that people may not solicit money within 50 feet of any place that makes financial transactions, which would include parking meters. The ACLU of Indiana has warned such an expansion of the law would virtually outlaw panhandling, which it says is protected by the First Amendment. But outgoing House Speaker Brian Bosma says something has to be done.
And I've come across three different groups that I've met nationally that have said they're not coming back to Indianapolis because of the aggressive panhandling here. It has to be dealt with.
Bosma says the effect on tourism hurts Indianapolis's and thus the state's economy. Lindsay, I've been trying to wrap my head around this. Is maybe the biggest problem here in trying to address panhandling that it's not quite as black and white as either side would like you to believe, because there is a link between panhandling and homelessness. But one side says most of these panhandlers are doing it on a professional basis. The other side says we need to treat homelessness, when in reality, it's all kind of intermingled.
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit more complex than I think some people would hope it to be. But because you're right, there is this overlap. And we heard from former Speaker Bosma talk about how he thinks this is kind of like a strategy, these panhandlers all get together and decide where they're going to go, and he's trying to address that. But another lawmaker brought up, put this ban on panhandling in downtown, but that could just push it somewhere else. So that's an issue. And then enforcement is going to be an issue because law enforcement almost has to witness this happening to be able to take action on it. So that's certainly going to play into how successful it'll be. But I think to Bosma's point, he saw this as something he could do now, and it's at least a first step.
Enforcement requires the bill to get to that, or the law to get to that point, and there's no guarantee it will.
Yeah, honestly, there's so much else going on. We haven't had a time to talk to Governor Holcomb to see whether he'd be willing to sign it into law.
But even if he does, it feels like there's going to be a lawsuit here, too.
The ACLU of Indiana has said they feel it's overly broad and unconstitutional, and I'm sure they would challenge it. Whether it's, allowed to go into effect first, I don't know. We'll have to see.
If not this specific law specifically written this way, is there something the state needs to do to address panhandling?
The only jurisdictions, panhandling is a problem, and it does discourage convention business and downtown development. I get that. But the only jurisdictions that have successfully dealt with this are the ones that do massive resources for people. Then you can separate the homeless, hopefully, separate and give services to the homeless and see who's doing it as a living instead of working. And that's the only way that I have seen in other jurisdictions a successful attempt to deal with this.
Is that the solution?
I don't disagree with that as a strategy. I mean, I think no one disagrees it's a problem. I mean,
yes.
I know people that are try to recruit some of these conventions to come to town. And they've had to adopt strategies on where in town they bring them, so that they're not going to go show them the Arts Garden because there's 25 people living under it.
Yeah. All right. Well, as I've mentioned several times, the 2020 session ended this week. Now, back in January, I asked some of the members of this panel for some predictions, including the session's biggest storyline.
I'm going to call it the do nothing session. They're starting late, leaving early, and making very clear they don't want to do much.
Right.
If we have this extra revenue, maybe we should spend it. That's the theme we'll be heard, repeated often.
Now, Lindsay, I'm not going to hold you accountable for a John Schwanes prediction, but I want to start. Let's revisit that question. Starting with Mike O'Brien, what was the biggest storyline of the 2020 session?
That Nikki got it dead wrong, that they weren't going to do anything. They did a lot. I'm not sure how much of it was necessary. They had 903 bills filed, 168 are eligible to pass the law, and that's a lot of work. I think the Curtis Hill issue.
In a short amount of time.
In a short amount of time. I mean, there was at one point early in the session, they were moving 100 bills a week. And that is hard if you work in that building to keep track of and keep your head around. The biggest story could be wind up being the Curtis Hill.
Which is something they didn't do, by the way.
Which is what they didn't do, right? That's a good point. That's a good point. A week ago, it was hospital costs. This week, I mean, Wednesday, we signed it out on Wednesday, and that was the day Corona was hitting the ceiling, so everything is secondary to that now.
Yeah. Biggest storyline of the session?
Oh, I think that the supermajority thought that they could slip things in to benefit their contributors, whether it's for charter schools or the coal industry, without any public without sufficient public input.
Storyline of the session.
Hey, I'm going to say they got a little done. They did
a slight revision
of
your
handheld cell phone law or the vaping stuff. They got some stuff done, but mostly sort of moderate tinkering around the edges.
To Nikki's point, and to help her defend her a little bit, they did get the healthcare stuff done, for example, but it's questionable how much impact is going to have.
Stay tuned. I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the next week or two, even as we're only talking about coronavirus. But finally, the end of the 2020 session also marked the end of Brian Bosma's 34-year legislative career, including a record 12 years as Speaker of the House. Ann Delaney, do you have a favorite Brian Bosma story that you can tell us on the air?
Well, I remember Brian Bosma speaking at the Gridiron one year and discussing the first couple's boudoir activity,
when Mike Pence was coming.
Right, which resulted in Karen Pence refusing to talk to him for several years. So, yeah, that's a problem. That, and of course, whoever thought that he'd outlast J. Roberts Daley as Speaker of the House? That's a pretty big accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Especially, in this day and age, to do that, too, is pretty impressive. Favorite Brian Bosma story?
You know, I think, generally, this session, one of the takeaways and one of the stories you wrote about just the process not really working very efficiently.
Yeah.
As he's taken a step out, I think, and I have all the faith in the world in Speaker Houston, but it takes a minute to get, and it took Brian Bosma a minute. I was there for the first session that Brian Bosma was Speaker in 2005 when I worked for Mitch Daniels. And it takes a long time to get the type of discipline and control over the process that Brian Bosma has had over the last several years. And really a respect for what he brought most of all is a respect for the institution, the process itself. And that needs to continue.
Except in certain areas.
might your favorite Brian Bosma story be the way he had a bad case of senioritis this week?
You know, I was going to say, so I wasn't around for a lot of time with Brian Bosma, but this week was, and really towards the end of session, just got very entertaining, and I loved the moment when Nikki brought in no-bake cookies, and the excitement that he had for those no-bake cookies was just great.
Cookies are also one of my favorite. Brian Bosma in a Girl Scout sash, eating Girl Scout cookies after Bob Morris famously went after the Girl Scouts, will always be up there.
Did you feel, though, to something Mike talked about, even before the official transition, did you feel Brian Bosma, did you feel that transition this whole session?
I don't think I felt it this whole session. I mean, things were certainly going on that he maybe wasn't the biggest fan of, and they were having to move bills back and forth. But some of it is, I just think, what happens when you've had a supermajority that long.
A reason
we'll not to have it anymore. We'll see. We'll see if that's still the case a year from now. But that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Lindsay Erdody of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Please stay safe and healthy as much as you can, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.